A reading from John Calvin's commentary on the Book of Psalms. Psalm 14. The fool has said in his heart, "There is no God. They have corrupted themselves. They have done abominable work. There is none that does good." In the beginning, the psalmist describes the wicked contempt of God into which almost the whole people had broken forth. To give the greater weight to his complaint, he represents God himself as uttering it. Afterwards, he comforts himself and others with the hope of a remedy, which he assures himself God will very soon provide, although in the meantime he groans and feels deep distress at the disorder which he beholds. Many of the Jews are of opinion that in this psalm there is given forth a prediction concerning the future oppression of their nation. It's if David, by the revelation of the Holy Spirit, bewail the afflicted condition of the Church of God under the tyranny of the Gentiles. They therefore refer what is here spoken to the dispersed condition in which we see them at the present day, as if they were that precious heritage of God which the wild beasts devour. But it is very apparent that in wishing to cover the disgrace of their nation, duress and apply to the Gentiles without any just ground, what is said concerning the perverse children of Abraham, we cannot certainly find a better qualified interpreter than the Apostle Paul, and he applies the psalm expressly to the people who lived under the law. Romans 3 verse 19. Besides, although we had not the testimony of this apostle, the structure of the psalm very clearly shows that David means rather the domestic tyrants and enemies of the faithful than foreign ones, a point in which it is very necessary for us to understand. We know that it is a temptation which pains us exceedingly to see wickedness breaking forth and prevailing in the midst of the church, the good and the simple unrighteously afflicted, while the wicked cruelly domineer according to their pleasure. This sad spectacle almost completely disheartens us, and therefore we have much need to be fortified from the example which David here sets before us, so that in the midst of the greatest desolations which we behold in the church, we may comfort ourselves with this assurance that God will finally deliver her from them. I have no doubt that there is here described a disordered and desolate state of Judea, which Saul introduced when he began to rage openly. Then, as if the remembrance of God had been extinguished from the minds of men, all piety had vanished, and with respect to integrity or uprightness among men, there was just as little of it as of godliness. The fool who said, as a Hebrew word, signifies not only a fool, but also a perverse, vile and contemptible person, it would not have been unsuitable to have translated it so in this place. Yet I am content to follow the more generally received interpretation, which is that all profane persons who have cast off all fear of God and abandoned themselves to iniquity are convicted of madness. David does not bring against his enemies the charge of common foolishness, but rather inveighs against the folly and insane hardihood of those whom the world accounts eminent for their wisdom. We commonly see that those who, in the estimation both of themselves and of others, highly excel in sagacity and wisdom, employ their cunning in laying snares and exercise the ingenuity of their minds in despising and mocking God. It is therefore important for us, in the first place, to know that however much the world applaud these crafty and scoffing characters who allow themselves to indulge to any extent in wickedness, yet the Holy Spirit condemns them as being fools, for there is no stupidity more brutish than forgetfulness of God. We ought, however, at the same time carefully to mark the evidence on which the psalmist comes to the conclusion that they have cast off all sense of religion, and it is this: that they have overthrown all order, so that they no longer make any distinction between right and wrong, and have no regard for honesty, nor love of humanity. David therefore does not speak of the hidden affection of the heart of the wicked, except in so far as they discover themselves by their external actions. The import of his language is How does it come to pass? Did these men indulge themselves in their lusts so boldly and so outrageously that they pay no regard to righteousness or equity? In short, that they madly rush into every kind of wickedness. If it is not because they have shaken off all sense of religion, and extinguished, as far as they can, all remembrance of God from their minds. When persons retain in their heart any sense of religion, they must necessarily have some modesty, and be in some measure restrained and prevented from entirely disregarding the dictates of their conscience. From this it follows that when the ungodly allow themselves to follow their own inclinations so obstinately and audaciously as they are here represented as doing, without any sense of shame, it is an evidence that they have cast off all fear of God. The psalmist says that they speak in their heart. They may not utter this detestable blasphemy, that there is no God, with their mouths, but the unbridled licentiousness of their life loudly and distinctly declares that in their hearts, which are destitute of all goodness, they susanly sing to themselves this song. Not that they maintain by drawn-out arguments or formal syllogisms, as they term them, that there is no God, for to render them so much the more inexcusable, God from time to time causes even the most wicked of men to feel secret pangs of conscience, that they may be compelled to acknowledge His majesty and sovereign power. But whatever right knowledge God instills into them, they partly stifle it by their malice against Him, and partly corrupt it, until religion in them becomes torpid, and at last dead. They may not plainly deny the existence of a God, but they imagine Him to be shut up in heaven and divested of His righteousness and power. And this is just to fashion an idol in the room of God, as if the time would never come when they will have to appear before Him in judgment. They endeavor in all the transactions and concerns of their lives to remove Him to the greatest distance, and to efface from their minds all apprehension of His majesty. And when God is dragged from His throne, and divested of His character as judge, impiety has come to its utmost height. And therefore we must conclude that David is most certainly spoken according to truth, in declaring that those who give themselves liberty to commit all manner of wickedness, in a flattering hope of escaping with impunity, deny in their heart that there is a God. It's a 53rd psalm, with the exception of a few words which are altered in it, is just a repetition of this psalm. I will show in the proper place as we proceed the difference which there is between the two psalms. David here complains that they have done abominable work, but for the word work, the term there employed is iniquity. It should be observed that David does not speak of one work, or of two, but, as he has said, that they have perverted or corrupted all lawful order. So now he adds that they have so polluted their whole life as to make it abominable. And the proof of this, which he adduces, is that they have no regard to uprightness in their dealings with one another, but have forgotten all humanity and all beneficence towards their fellow creatures. Verse 2. Jehovah looked down from heaven upon the children of men, to see whether there were any that did understand and seek after God. Every one of them has gone aside. They have altogether become putrid or rotten. There is none that does good, not even one. Jehovah looked down from heaven. God Himself is here introduced as speaking on the subject of human depravity. And this renders the discourse of David more emphatic than if he had pronounced a sentence in his own person, when God is exhibited to us as sitting on a throne to take cognizance of the conduct of men, unless we are stupefied in an extraordinary degree, His majesty must strike us with terror. The effect of the habit of sinning is did men grow hardened in their sins and discern nothing, as if they were enveloped in thick darkness. David, therefore, to teach them that they gain nothing by flattering and deceiving themselves as they do, when wickedness reigns in the world with impunity, testifies that God looks down from heaven and casts his eyes on all sides for the purpose of knowing what is done among men. God, it is true, has no need to make inquisition or search, but when he compares himself to an earthly judge, it is an adaptation to our limited capacity and to enable us gradually to form some apprehension of his secret providence, which our reason cannot all at once comprehend. Would to God that this manner of speaking had the effect of teaching us to summon ourselves before his tribunal, and that, while the world is flattering itself and the reprobate is trying to bury his sins and forgetfulness by the lack of thought, hypocrisy or shamelessness, and are blinded in their obstinacy as if they were intoxicated, we might be led to shake off all indifference and stupidity by reflecting on this truth, that God, notwithstanding, looks down from his high throne in heaven, and he beholds what is going on here below, to see if there were any that did understand. As the whole economy of a good and righteous life depends upon our being governed and directed by the light of understanding, David has justly taught us in the beginning of the psalm that folly is the root of all wickedness. And in this clause, he also very justly declares that the commencement of integrity and uprightness of life consists in an enlightened and sound mind. But as the greater part misapply their intellectual powers to deceitful purposes, David immediately after defines in one word what true understanding is, namely that it consists in seeking after God, by which he means that unless men devote themselves wholly to God, their life cannot be well ordered. Some understand the word maskil, which we translated, that did understand, in too restricted a sense, whereas David declares that the reprobate are utterly destitute of all reason and judgment. Every one of them is gone aside. Some translate the word sar, which is here used, to stink, as if the reading were every one of them emits an offensive odor, that it may correspond in meaning with the verb in the next clause, which in Hebrew signifies to become putrid or rotten, but there is no necessity for explaining the two words in the same way, as if the same thing were repeated twice. The interpretation is more appropriate, which supposes that men are here condemned as guilty of a detestable revolt, inasmuch as they are estranged from God, or have departed far from him, and then afterwards there is pointed out the disgusting corruption or putrescence of their whole life, as if nothing could proceed from apostates but what smells rank of rottenness and infection. The Hebrew word sar is almost universally taken in this sense. In the 51st Psalm, the word zag is used, which signifies the same thing. In short, David declares that all men are so carried away by their capricious lusts that nothing is to be found either of purity or integrity in their whole life. This, therefore, is defection so complete that it extinguishes all godliness. Besides, David here not only censures a portion of the people, but pronounces them all to be equally involved in the same condemnation. This was indeed a prodigy well fitted to excite abhorrence, that all the children of Abraham, whom God had chosen to be his peculiar people, were so corrupt, from the least to the greatest. But it might be asked how David makes no exception, how he declares that not a righteous person remains, not even one, when nevertheless he informs us a little after that the poor and afflicted would put their trust in God. Again, it might be asked, if all were wicked, who is that Israel whose future redemption he celebrates in the end of the psalm? Nay, as he himself was one of the body of that people, why does he not at least accept himself? I answer It is against the carnal and degenerate body of the Israelitish nation that he here invades. And a small number constituting a seed which God had set apart for himself is not included among them. This is the reason why Paul in his epistle to the Romans 3 verse 10 extends his sentence to all mankind. David, it is true, deplores the disordered and desolate state of matters under the reign of Saul. At the same time, however, he doubtless makes a comparison between the children of God and all who have not been regenerated by the Spirit, but are carried away according to the inclinations of their flesh. Some give a different explanation, maintaining that Paul, by quoting the testimony of David, did not understand him as meaning that men are naturally depraved and corrupt, and that the truth which David intended to teach is that the rulers and the more distinguished of the people were wicked, and that therefore it was not surprising to behold unrighteousness and wickedness prevailing so generally in the world. This answer is far from being satisfactory. The subject which Paul there reasons upon is not what is the character of the greater part of men, but what is the character of all who are led and governed by their own corrupt nature. It is, therefore, to be observed that when David places himself and the small remnant of the godly on one side and puts on the other the body of the people in general, this implies that there is a manifest difference between the children of God who are created anew by His Spirit and all the posterity of Adam, in whom corruption and depravity exercise dominion. Whence it follows that all of us, when we are born, bring with us from our mother's womb this folly and filthiness manifested in the whole life, which David here describes, and that we continue such until God makes us new creatures by His mysterious grace. Psalm 14, verse 4. If all the workers of iniquity know knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and they call not upon the Lord. The question is added to give a more amplified illustration of the preceding doctrine. The prophet had said that God observed from heaven the doings of men, and had found all of them gone out of the way. And now he introduces him, exclaiming with astonishment, "What madness is this, that they who ought to cherish my people and assiduously perform to them every kind office are oppressing and falling upon them like wild beasts without any feeling of humanity?" He attributes this manner of speaking to God not because anything can happen which is strange or unexpected to him, but in order the more forcibly to express his indignation. The prophet Isaiah in like manner, Isaiah 59 verse 16, when treating of almost the same subject, says, "And God saw that there was no man, and wondered that there was no intercessor." God, it is true, does not actually experience in himself such affections, but he represents himself as infested with them, that we may entertain the greatest horror and dread on account of our sins, when he declares them to be of so monstrous a character that he, as it were thrown into agitation and disorder by them. "And were we not harder than the stones, our horror at the wickedness which prevails in the world would make the hair of our head to stand on end." Seeing God exhibits to us in his own person such a testimony of the detestation with which he regards it. Moreover, this verse confirms what I have said in the commencement, that David does not speak in the psalm of foreign tyrants, or the avowed enemies of the church, but of the rulers and princes of his people, who were furnished with power and honor. This description would not apply to men who were altogether strangers to the revealed will of God, for it would be nothing wonderful to see those who do not possess the moral law, the rule of life, devoting themselves to the work of violence and oppression. But the heinousness of the proceedings condemned is not a little aggravated from this circumstance, that it is the shepherds themselves whose office it is to feed and take care of the flock, who cruelly devour it, and who spare not even the people and heritage of God. There is a similar complaint in Micah 3, verses 1 to 3. And I said, Hear, I pray you, heads of Jacob, and you princes of the house of Israel. Is it not for you to know judgment, who hate the good and love the evil, who pluck off their skin from off them and their flesh from off their bones, who also eat the flesh of my people and slay their skin from off of them, and so on? If those who profess to know and to serve God were to exercise such cruelty towards the Babylonians or Egyptians, it would be a piece of injustice which could admit of no excuse. But when they glut themselves with the blood and flesh of the saints, as they devour bread, this is such a monstrous iniquity that it may well strike both angels and men with astonishment. Had such persons a particle of sound understanding remaining in them, it would restrain them from conduct so fearfully infatuated. They must therefore be completely blinded by the devil and utterly bereft of reason and understanding, seeing they knowingly and willingly slay and devour the people of God with such inhumanity. This passage teaches us how displeasing to God and how abominable is the cruelty which is exercised against the godly by those who pretend to be their shepherds. In the end of the verse, where he says that they call not upon the Lord, he again points out the source and cause of this unbridled wickedness, namely that such persons have no reverence for God. Religion is the best mistress for teaching us mutually to maintain equity and uprightness towards each other. And where concern for religion is extinguished, then all regard for justice perishes along with it. With respect to the phrase calling upon God, as it constitutes a principal exercise of godliness, it includes by synecdoche a figure of rhetoric by which a part is put for the whole. Not only here, but in many other passages of Scripture, the whole of the service of God. Psalm 14, verses 5 and 6. There did they tremble with fear, for God is in the generation of the righteous. You deride the counsel of the poor, because Jehovah is his hope. There did they tremble with fear. The prophet now encourages himself and all the faithful with the best of all consolations, namely, that God will not forsake his people even to the end, but will at length show himself to be their defender. Some explain the adverb of place there as meaning that God will take vengeance on the wicked in the presence of his saints, because they exercise their tyranny upon them. But I rather think that by this word there is expressed a certainty of their punishment. It is the psalmist pointed to it with a finger. It may also intimate what we may gather from Psalm 53, that the judgment of God would come upon them suddenly, and when they were not thinking about it. For it is there added, where no fear is, or where no fear was. Expositors, I am aware, differ in their interpretation of these words. Some supply the word equal, or like, and read, there is no fear equal to it. Others refer them to those secret alarms with which the ungodly are tormented, even when there may be no ground for apprehension. God threatens the transgressors of his law with such mental torment that they shall flee when none pursues them. Leviticus 26, verse 17, and Proverbs 28, verse 1, and at the sound of a shaking leaf shall chase them. Leviticus 26, verse 36. Just as we see that they are themselves their own tormentors, and are agitated with mental trouble even when there is no external cause to create it. But I think the meaning of the prophet is different, namely, that when their affairs are in a state of the greatest tranquility and prosperity, God will suddenly launch against them the bolts of his vengeance. For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3. The prophet therefore encourages and supports the faithful with this prospect, that the ungodly, when they think themselves free from all danger, and are securely celebrating their own triumphs, shall be overwhelmed with sudden destruction. The reason of this is added in the last clause of the verse, namely, because God is determined to defend the righteous and to take in hand their cause, for God is in the generation of the righteous. Now, in order to preserve them safe, he must necessarily thunder in his wrath from heaven against their enemies, who unjustly oppress and waste them by violence and extortion. There is, however, some ambiguity in the word door, which we have translated generation, as this noun in Hebrew sometimes signifies an age, or the course of human life. The sentence might be explained as follows. Although God for a time may seem to take no notice of the wrongs inflicted upon his servants by the wicked, yet he is ever present with them, and exercises his grace towards them during their whole life. But it seems to me a more simple and natural exposition to interpret the clause thus, that God is on the side of the righteous, and takes their part, as we say, so that door will have the same signification here which the word nation sometimes has among the Latins. In Psalm 53, verse 5, the psalmist adds a sentence which does not occur in this psalm, for God has scattered the bones of him that besieges thee. Thou shalt put them to shame, because God hath rejected them. By these words, the prophet explains more clearly how God protects the righteous, that is, by delivering them from the jaws of death. Just as if one were to put to flight those who had laid siege to a town and were to set at liberty its inhabitants, who before were in great extremity and quite shut up. Whence it follows that we must patiently bear oppression if we desire to be protected and preserved by the hand of God at the time of our greatest danger. The expression bones is used metaphorically for strength or power. The prophet particularly speaks of their power. For if the wicked were not possessed of riches, ammunition, and troops which render them formidable, it would not appear with sufficient evidence that it is the hand of God which at length crushes them. The psalmist next exhorts the faithful to a holy boasting, and bids them rest assured that an ignominious destruction hangs over the heads of the wicked. The reason of this is because God has rejected them, and if he is opposed to them, all things must ultimately go ill with them. As mass, which we have translated to reject, sometimes signifies to despise. Some render it thus, because God has despised them. But this, I think, does not suit the passage. It would be more appropriate to read, he has rendered them contemptible, or subjected them to disgrace and ignominy. Whence it follows that they only draw down upon themselves dishonor and infamy while they strive to elevate themselves, as it were, in despite of God. Verse 6, you deride the counsel of the poor. He inveighs against those giants who mock at the faithful for their simplicity, and come expecting in their distresses that God will show himself to be their deliverer. And certainly nothing seems more irrational to the flesh than to betake ourselves to God when yet he does not relieve us from our calamities. And the reason is because the flesh judges of God only according to what it presently beholds of his grace. Whenever, therefore, unbelievers see the children of God overwhelmed with calamities, they reproach them for their groundless confidence, as it appears to them to be, and with sarcastic jeers laugh at the assured hope with which they rely upon God, from whom, notwithstanding, they receive no sensible aid. David, therefore, defies and derides this insolence of the wicked, and threatens at their mockery of the poor and the wretched, in their charging them with folly and depending upon the protection of God, and not sinking under their calamities will be the cause of their destruction. At the same time, he teaches them that there is no resolution to which we can come which is better advised than the resolution to depend upon God, and that to repose on his salvation and on the assistance which he has promised us, even although we may be surrounded with calamities. It is the highest wisdom.